copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
My topic, we were talking with David about what to do and what where I could maybe fit. I wrote a book on preaching. I've been teaching about preaching in almost all continents in different settings, missionary settings, Bible Institute settings, coaching of experienced pastors and preachers. So it's been interesting to observe, and I've kind of worked on a bit of an approach to it. It's not the best approach. It's one approach to it. But through that, I've come to think about the role of emotions in preaching. It was just one small part of what I've come to study and encourage. And that's what I want to talk about at this session. And I imagine that when I speak of emotions in preaching, perhaps you think about the preacher that cries, you know, with tears rolling when he speaks about different subjects, and you're like, eh, I'm not sure about that. Or perhaps you think about people that manipulate emotions so that they can induce a behavior or a change in person, or someone who is more or less hysterical. And it's really not what I want to point out. So, and by the way, if you do that, that's okay too. But this is not the topic that I want to address, but more to see how there are emotions in scriptures, and there are emotions in our lives, of course. And that perhaps can be a bridge to both be faithful and relevant, which I think is really the challenge of the day. And there are many challenges about preaching today. So I will share my screen. You have the PowerPoint available on your notes, and I can share my notes complete if you're interested. And what I have here on the screen is really just illustrative, more than anything else. But we do have a number of challenges as we are preachers, right? As preachers, in the 70s, people were confronted to about 1,000 ads a day. Now that's already a lot, right? But in 2021, we are exposed between 6,000 and 10,000 ads every day. Now, this is a ton of messages that are coming our way. Big revenues, $134 billion for Google, $40 for Facebook. And there's a lot of competition for our attention, for the attention of the people. People spend about 3 to 4 hours a day in the USA watching TV. In Europe, it's 2 to 3 hours. Japan, it's 1 hour a day. About 300 hours of YouTube videos are uploaded every minute, and YouTube viewing increases by 60% a year. 1 billion videos are watched every day. So when we come on Sunday morning and we preach, people have been exposed to all kinds of messages, all kinds of emotions, all kinds of movies and settings and situations, sometimes brilliantly exposed to actually manipulate us, and sometimes with great storylines. And we come on Sunday and we gather and we're supposed to be preaching. Well, as you can imagine, it's not easy to keep the attention of people. As you know, it's not easy to keep the attention. Perhaps you have already tuned me out and are already looking at your emails. I don't know. But videos, 20% will leave the video after 10 seconds. That's amazing, right? Web articles, 50% stay less than 15 seconds per page. So when you write a blog article, you know that gives you an idea of how long people's attentions are for, you know. Web users spend 69% of their time viewing the left half of a page and 30% viewing the right. Now, obviously, that has implication for you as preachers. You should always preach from the left side of your notes. Just kidding. Anyways, that shows, you know, people are distracted. We are more and more distracted. And add to this another issue, and I'll just stop sharing for a second. You know that sociologists think of the way that groups think and behave, and they've come up with different ways of kind of framing the cultural setting of people. And a missionary from our mission, Jason George, in the book called 3D Gospel, said that there are basically three moral emotions that have become the foundation for three types of culture. One is guilt, innocence, mostly in Western worlds. The other is shame, honor, mostly in North African, Asian as well, culture. And then fear, power, mostly in Africa and Asia as well. Am I losing anyone on that? Perhaps we can discuss that in the question answers. And it's just that people think in terms of good and bad according to that. Well, I'm suggesting to you that there's something new arising in our Western world, which is not strictly shame, honor, not strictly guilt, innocence, but it's pleasure and pain. And I think more and more the world today in the West think of right and wrong in terms of, does it bring me pleasure? It's good. Does it give me pain? It's bad. Now, I have in my notes, you'll read a quote that is a bit more extensive, but somebody has written, a philosopher has written, culture is hard to define, religion is hard to interpret, and feelings are unreliable, but pain and pleasure are simple. If something hurts, it's bad. If it feels good, it's good. It should be much easier to use pain and pleasure to decide what is morally right and wrong. So I think the culture is fast evolving on this kind of situation, and it follows this maxim, enjoy and give joy without hurting either yourself nor anyone else. That's all of morality. Now that's a kind of mindset that people more and more, not necessarily directly, have absorbed, but that's what they are coming with. I don't know if you'll agree with that. Now, that kind of creates a silent background for what happens when people come to church, as a gathered church this time, because we are the church. We don't really come to church. We gather as a church, as we know. And now imagine that, in pointing that out, I don't mean that our sermons should be giving pleasure. I mean, they should in some ways, but sometimes they should give us pain, you know, confront us to the issues of our days, of our lives. But nonetheless, there is a sense of expectations that it needs to keep me on edge, and it needs to kind of call my attention to something. So let's not talk about what is preaching. Now, there are a lot of definitions of preaching, and I won't, you know, bore you with that. Your experience in ministry, and you probably have your own definition. In the book I write with a colleague, we think of the proclamation of a text of scripture that is analyzed in its context to deduct or deduce its meaning. And then that meaning becomes the main theme of the message that will be delivered to a specific audience for their salvation and growth. Other definitions would be possible. And basically, it's to be faithful to an unchangeable word of God, just like Dr. Moeller exhorted us yesterday to keep in mind. Now, the problem is it's not a problem, but that definition can also give us the tendency to see preaching as dumping information faithfully. Now, dumping information faithfully is good because it's true, it's faithful, and it's important to be truthful and faithful. But at the same time, it's not necessarily what we see preaching to be, both in the Old Testament and New Testament. There's more momentum attached to the idea of preaching. And of course, we know that God in his sovereignty will use just about everything he wants to use in his truth to accomplish his purposes. I don't know if you know the story of the conversion of our kind of model in preaching in many ways, Spurgeon. You know how Spurgeon got saved. He got saved through what probably was the worst sermon ever pronounced on the face of the earth. But of course, and I say that kind of jokingly, the pastor was gone, an elderly man was there, and he did his best. And basically, he repeated for 45 minutes that we needed to look to Jesus to be saved. And he needed to keep, you know, the attention of the two or three people that were gathered there by simply repeating what he knew. And yet that is what God used to save Spurgeon. So God will use whatever he wants to accomplish his purposes. But this being said, our task is not only to be faithful to the scriptures and to do our best, but also to understand what our audience, who our audience is, and how to connect to that audience. And that touches the issue of relevancy. Relevancy, John Stott describes the discipline of preaching as a bridge connecting two worlds, the biblical text and our world. And he encourages the preacher to study those two elements and allow the Bible to impact our world. And we know how God, whenever he sought to connect with us, he did use humanly understandable ways, well, you know, in the way that he spoke, in the way that, we won't go into that unless there are questions into that. And what I want to point out is that relevancy, and that's really going to be the focus now in the rest of my talk, is that relevancy involves really understanding where the people are, thus understanding the elements of introduction that I gave, and to provide the kind of laser focus that alerts them that this is really coherent in what they hear about in the Bible for their lives. And I think emotions are part of that. So in the process that that I use in the book I wrote and in the teaching that I give on preaching, I go over seven steps. And one of those steps, I call it amplification. And this amplification is looking at the text to note the emotions, the motivation, the hope or hopes, and then choose explanations and illustrations and applications that bridge the scriptures to our lives. And that really emotions should be a part of that. Now, thus far, I think it's, I hope you can follow and that's clear enough, but what are emotions? Actually, it's an interesting field to study. And more studies are being done on different aspects of that. An author speaks of emotions as both feeling and thinking, the particular psychological and biological states, and the range of tendencies to behave accordingly. Right? There's both physical aspect, there's the way we feel and think, and that's what is interesting for us preachers, we tend to align our behavior according to our feelings. Now remember too what I said about the tendency of our culture, pleasure, pain. More and more people are aligning their behaviors according to whatever they feel brings them pleasure. Well, sometimes in twisted ways, the other way around, whatever brings pain to them, but that's another issue. Another specialist in emotions says that most biologists agree that emotions play a determining role in their organization of behavior. I don't know if you'll agree to that. But I think that we've all experienced the times that of lamentation that we find in the Psalms, and that it led our behavior accordingly, a behavior that we see even in the Psalms. And that we needed to also take a hold of God's promises to not just simply listen to our emotions, but actually listen to God's truth to lift up our emotions and nurture them differently, backed with truth, in order to change behavior. What is fascinating is that the more we study emotions and the more we study the way that we function in our brain, the more we realize that we're actually mirroring the emotions that we see around us. I read a book recently dedicated, written by several neurosurgeons or neurospecialists, and they speak of what is called mirror neurons. And I don't know if you're familiar with the issue, but this is what they say. I think it's fascinating. They say, in fact, we catch the emotions of others like viruses, both positive and negative. As soon as we enter into a relationship with someone, millions of our neurons literally try to connect with those of the other person. As a result, our brain is not the same depending on whether we find our interlocutor to be more or less friendly, interesting, funny, tonic, exciting, stupid, suspicious, soft, rigid, dangerous, etc. If someone attacks us by shouting, the same zones will be activated in our brains in a few seconds, whether we like it or not. And I think that has a lot of consequences on our approach to preaching and our approach to depicting the emotions that we find in the scriptures. So what can we say, biblically speaking, about emotions? So far, I've quoted a few of these specialists, sociologists, or doctors. Well, I think our tendency as Christians tend to oversimplify or minimize or exalt emotions. And I think that these are three mistakes that we Christians tend to make. I'm not saying that we all do, but I think in the early stages of my Christian life, I have way oversimplified and minimized emotions. And I think to a fault. And I've had to balance my way of thinking. I think the Bible values emotional life. We should not be controlled by it, but they are there and they express themselves. And there are a lot of things that we can learn from the scriptures about our emotions. But the way perhaps we should look at it is that they're neither good or bad, but depending on the context of their expression and the direction that they lead us to, then they become morally connected. And with that in mind, we can look at all kinds of emotional events in the Bible that really we should be able to portray correctly so as to create a momentum towards loving God, loving others. I mean, think about the story of Hosea. You know, that's one of the highest emotional moment of scriptures in the Old Testament. What an incredible story that we should be able to depict. The way that the revival led to people crying in Esdras to the point of the priest saying, hey, stop crying, start drinking, be merry. I mean, I've never had that experience in our church, you know, that kind of situation. God's coming to Jonas and say, are you okay to be angry or to be sad? There are a lot of moments where we see emotions really radically capturing people's hearts. So what do we do practically? Now let's move on to what do we do if those information that I've shared are correct to use emotions appropriately in a context of preaching. Perhaps you know the book, Dig Deeper, Bainan and Sack, just a great book, simple book on hermeneutics. And there are 16 steps to discover the meaning of a text. The ninth step says the following. The tone and feel tool reminds us that as we come to the Bible, we should pay attention not only to the point that is being made, although that is the first priority, but also how it is being made. We must not reduce the richness of the Bible literature simply to a list of logical statements. We want to be alert to the author's tone, to immerse ourselves in the picture that he paints in such a way that our imaginations are awakened and our emotions are engaged. We ought to experience the urgency of 2 Timothy 4, the anguish of Lamentations 1, the majesty of Job 38, the relief of 2 Samuel 22, the joy of Ephesians 1. It's right to cry sometimes when we read the Bible. And when the Psalms tell us to shout for joy, we should do that too. And so how do we do that? How is it relevant and pertinent in our preaching? Well, I suggest that as you study the text of scriptures, you begin to think, what emotions are there? Implicit emotions and explicit emotions. The explicit emotions are simple. They're there on the surface. The implicit emotions are harder to find. For example, when Paul tells the Thessalonians to, and I'll stop the sharing for a second, when Paul tells the Thessalonians about choosing elders and he says, you know, be united, that, you know, stay together. The underlying emotion here is that when you choose elders, sometimes there's jealousy in the, you know, in the church. I want to be one, some of them may think, or I wouldn't want this one. So when you observe those emotions that are implicit in the text, actually, by preaching through it, about it, and on it, you allow the person to connect to the reality of where they live. Perhaps at work, somebody else gets a promotion and not them. Perhaps in the church, somebody is asked to do a task and not them. It creates a bridge that is useful. So when we study a biblical text, it's interesting really to think, are there emotions there? And emotions that are not among the simple ones to express, you know, joy, anger, sadness, that's it. No, be a bit more like, use dictionaries or synonyms to try to carve the emotions, understand the emotions that are right there in the text. And as you do so, it's actually something that you can use to say, well, what aspects of my life, in what context am I experiencing those emotions as well? Because then that becomes something easy to create a bridge to our lives. A Dancer, who I'm not sure I quoted him, but I had a quote in my notes, says that in our Western culture, there are more than 1,000 different terms for different emotions, even though we only use about 1/10 of them. And so we need to think, you know, what is there in the text very precisely chiseled that we need to take out? And how does that represent a life situation that I can use to in my context? So you see the emotions in the text, in the scriptures. You think of emotions in our context, in our lives. And then really, you need to absorb those emotions. That's at least what I have in my notes, I mean, in your outline for the speech. And what I mean by that is to internalize them. To think, you know, in what context do I experience this? And that sets up the next stage of using emotions, which basically involves illustrations, applications, and particularly introduction and conclusion. Discerning emotional bridges is kind of an art, but it's so powerful. So, for example, when you look at the Psalm 3, and the Psalm 3 starts with, "O Lord, how many are my foes?" What is interesting in that statement is that, you know, 2/3 of the Psalms are lament, as you know, and we rarely lament, or we rarely know how to lament. But that Psalm, David laments about the circumstances that are coming upon him. He's fleeing his son, who's taking over, or is trying to take over the kingship of Israel, of Judah, of Israel. And it is his fault, because this happens as a consequence of his own sins. So he's experiencing deep emotions of sadness, of being surrounded with enemies. And he has only himself to blame, because it's a consequence of his own sin. Well, as you think about that, so many people in our context, in our church context, feel extreme emotional pain because they have sinned, because they have said things they shouldn't have said to a relative, to a spouse, to a child, to a coworker, or and sometimes, but by pointing that out in the text and in our lives, people connect immediately with their own situation and with the rest of the Psalms that speaks about lifting, you're the one who will lift my head up. And I'm sorry, the Psalm comes to my mind in French, and so I should have quoted the whole Psalm to give a proper quote. And there are all kinds of situations that we can talk about or describe that would be similar illustrations are probably the easiest way to connect with emotions. A story, a biography, a testimony, a narrative, a situation with the audience will immediately connect, and that's an easy way to do. But think of the correspondence of emotions as one of the possible bridge. Application, remember that the emotions that we experience really lead us to behavior. So when you study, for example, Proverbs chapter 5, you know, in the book of Proverbs, you have two chapters that are dedicated to be careful with adultery. And Proverbs 5 is more of a, it begins with an emotional adultery, then becomes a sexual adultery, and then you reap the consequences of that. Chapter 7 is more of a, it's not a friendship that begins, it's more like a lust that begins. Two types of adultery, still the same, obviously, at the end of the day. But nonetheless, it's different. It starts with emotions that, you know, she said kind words, and it felt so good. Emotionally, people can connect with that situation. But then at the end of chapter 5, it speaks of all the consequences, and some of them are physical consequences, possibly venereal diseases, as you read in the text. But the other one is deep, profound regret that a person wants to throw up for what has happened. Now, if you can bridge those emotions with real life, people will not only understand, yeah, adultery, God says no, period. But it's also a deep emotional satisfaction at first that becomes a nightmare after. That's another way to say it. And it does not negate the absolute law, no adultery. But it's also pointing out that there's a wise law because of the emotional, among other things, consequences and way that it comes. So my time is up. I have two more minutes and I'll try to use them best with two things. Well, yeah, just a couple of comments. Introduction and conclusion. You understand that in your introduction, do you know how many seconds people give you before they decide to listen to you or not? In the secular world, it's about 8 seconds. So we need to create a connection immediately with an audience, especially an audience that you don't know, or especially an audience with non-believers present, which is always the situation we want to have as a church people. So we need to connect emotionally, relationally, and that has to do with our face, the way we look, the way we speak, what we talk about in the initial moment of the preaching. And then what I find important is encouragement. The grace of God, says Titus chapter 2, trains us to renounce ungodliness. And encouragement has much more powerful impact on obedience long term than guilt does. Because guilt, you obey immediately. You really are pushed to do something immediately. But when we encourage redemptively, just like the flow of the thought of Titus 2, people want to move forward towards the love of God. And there's an emotional component to that. So that leaves us with the last element, using emotions, using emotions properly is not about being emotional. It's about creating those bridges that people will connect. You probably have heard Timothy Keller's preaching. I find him to be highly emotional, even though he's very even in his speech, but he connects well with his audience and he connects well with the emotions of the day and of the people that he's talking to. Well, I hope that that has been helpful. I'll end with one quote by a secular author. He says, "When we know how interpersonal relationships are fundamentally emotional, we understand why this capacity for interpretation is so essential as it conditions their quality and readability. It allows you to adapt your behaviors to others. It is therefore not surprising to see this as becoming a very persuasive mode of communication." Thank you for your attention.